81K262. Now, consider what becomes of the human being failing to achieve or receive the Dithyon state, Jung's individuation or integration of the opposites, chemical wedding, mysterium coniunctionis, whatever, birth in the spirit, anyhow, the event in which what was not there before is there now, and it acts to complement what was there that in itself was incomplete. So that the result is wholeness or, as I like to call it, justification. The human being recirculates the same ideas, info, over and over again. And according to the statistical laws regarding entropy, the degree of order in the info irreversibly decreases, disorder increases, and the person mentally and spiritually moves inexorably toward death. Now, Schrödinger contends that a biological organism postpones its death, thermal equilibrium, by maintaining a relatively high level of order by incorporating negative entropy from its environment. And this is precisely the entering of the adventitious psyche. It is either injected or is ingested, offered by the environment or taken from it. In any case, what was outside the organism is now inside the organism and incorporated into one total structure with what was already there, i.e., it is assimilated, so to speak, digested and incorporated, although not without some initial perturbation, defined as disorder. What was already there and what was intaken must ultimately either form a unity or, equally useful, maybe even more useful, a push-pull dialectic of complementary opposites, in which each half corrects the other, monitors the other, acts as a feedback circuit, producing a self-winding autonomous totality. Thus, the two halves are not identical. The psyche has not split in two, quite the contrary. I became conscious of the difference when I first researched the meanings of the prefix die, and saw that it can either mean double or asunder, implying either a joining of two elements or a splitting of one element into halves. These are antithetical notions. So perhaps assimilate is the wrong word. Reach a working relationship with, or enter into a partnership with, enter into a syzygy would be better. As a strategy for prolonging its life, this is representative of the strategies of organisms by and large. But what I see here is an extraordinarily high degree of incorporation of negentropy from the environment and subsequent incorporation into the organism's own structure. There is an initial perturbation defined as disorder. If all goes well, the organism now possesses a vast increase in its level of complexity, in energy, drastic increase in all the factors by which the capacity for biological survival is measured. Hence, it is brought into prolonged vitality, viability, and extended life. The issue being exactly that, life versus death. This extraordinary strategy is engaged in by an organism that is approaching death and knows it. It has run out of time. It is vitiated. It is ossified. Its environment has been pressing against its perimeter, threatening to invade and annihilate it. The level of internal organization has been lowering it. The organism perceives the ratio of order in it and outside it, progressing toward less and less internal order, greater and greater exterior, external order. Now the concept expressed in the Dithyon dream fits in with Erwin Schrödinger's analysis of how any living organism delays its decay into thermal equilibrium, death, by its capacity to maintain itself at a fairly high level of orderliness, and hence fairly low level of entropy, by continually absorbing negative entropy from its environment. In fact, Schrödinger's analysis tends to support the idea that indeed the second psyche is adventitious in origin, because this is only an unusual example of the fundamental way by which organisms delay death, perhaps the only way they do so, can do so. Then this transaction represents a turnaround in what has been going on between the declining, dying organism and its environment, as if, at the last moment, the beleaguered organism turned the tables on its environment and converted an invasion into an acquisition. Having allowed the invasion to occur, it must now assimilate into its structure what it has allowed to come in, or even induced into coming in. This, when studied from this fundamental standpoint, doesn't seem to differ qualitatively from what protozoa do. It is not a basic strategy, it is the basic strategy. The irreducible transaction between a biological organism and its environment for the purpose of prolonging the life of the organism. Now, what strikes me at this point is that perhaps this transaction can be viewed in terms of information. First, the lowered structural organization of the organism should be regarded as connoting info scarcity or depletion, at least relative to its environment. It, the organism, does not know enough. It experiences this as a heightened strangeness, incomprehensibility, and unpredictability on the part of its environment, all of which renders that environment threatening because it is not understood. This could account for many of the fugal tactics by schizophrenics. They retreat from reality because reality is making less and less sense to them. But this, in fact, is not due to transformations in reality, but in the relative information that the schizophrenic has about reality. And as he withdraws, he escalates this disparity. By exercising progressively less reality testing, he learns less and less. This is a self-defeating tactic, this attempt at disengagement. The solution is for him to advance into reality and, so to speak, capture and incorporate a sizable hunk of it without at the same time losing his own identity. That is, if the incorporated hunk of reality proves to exceed his capacity to assimilate it, he is doomed to swift annihilation. In fact, what was perceived formerly as an external threat is now literally internal and still a threat. In fact, the threat has won out. The battle is over and the organism dies. Viewed this way, this massive incorporation of its environment is a desperate last strategy based on the recognition that unless it does this, it is certainly doomed. It must be convinced that any alternative means inexorable death. So the massive incorporation is an endgame battle to which it commits itself utterly, knowing the danger in what it is doing, but knowing also the alternatives. They are dead ends, but now it has two centers, its own self and the self that it has incorporated but not assimilated. Its environment is literally inside it and experienced from inside. That is, its now incorporated environment is known by its inward face as an I, not an it, a sort of potentially lethal movement along Martin Buber's it-thou axis. The it has become a thou, which is good, but the thou is inside the organism as a second center or focus of consciousness. The boundary between the organism and its environment is eradicated, which potentially is death for the organism. Death in its true and total form. This is what organisms rightly fear the most. Yet apparently, it has decided to allow this invasion as a means to incorporate negentropy, which it must continually do. And so the possibility of enhancing its viability, as opposed to being engulfed, is there. How should it proceed? How does it go about dealing with an influx of reality so vast that it constitutes a second center of consciousness? First of all, it must deal with the startling discovery that what it has ingested, but not assimilated, is, like itself, conscious and even coherent. It and its acquisition, or invader, are roughly isomorphic. Hence, the adventitious psyche is perceived as human, a crucial point. Crucial because if human, it is not fremd, it is other, yet familiar in kind. Presumably, too, it is finite, since humans are finite. Next, it is discovered that this adventitious psyche is bewildered, as if plucked from its own familiar environment, and deposited in a strange time and place. Thus, it is at a disadvantage. It does not know how it got there, nor does it know the local customs or even the language, all of which creates the impression that it did not intend to invade, does not understand the situation, and means no harm. Its motivation is the same as the host organism's, to survive. Was it just last Friday night that I stumbled at last onto the realization of justification? This is Sunday night. And I felt such pain, because the exegesis is over, and I knew it. And as I wrote, the real purpose of this exegesis has not been to find the answer, but to preserve the experience. 81 K 310. There is something I must face, and face fully and honestly. The messenger vision. That was, first of all, not a dream but a vision, although perhaps hypnopompic. What I must face is that it sums up and expresses absolutely, precisely, and perfectly what I discovered recently to be the very essence of Protestantism, the doctrine of unmerited justification by Christ's surrogate act, death. The complexities of this specifically Protestant doctrine, which is, as I say, not a belief of Protestantism, but its very basis, are wonderfully clarified by that vision. Now, I see myself falling back on what the Reformers, following Paul, called legalism. This is when you obsessively and neurotically calculate and recalculate whether or not you have observed every regulation and piled up enough merit by your own efforts. And of course, you never have and never will. There always remains a bill of particulars, and you know it. There is always something left undone or done imperfectly, or something done wrong. It never ends. There is endless nagging worry and a sense of being imperfect. Your conscience will always accuse you. Interjected authority transformed into awareness of guilt, which is to say, falling short, the literal meaning of sin. What I must, simply must realize, is that it has been supernaturally revealed to me that Paul's basic idea of justification through God's unmerited grace, divine favor and mercy, upon which Protestantism is based, is true. As I sit here at this moment, I realize that I will always fall short, however hard I try to do right. I cannot on my own save myself, and am doomed. And yet I am saved by the messenger with the spotless sheet of paper that he presents to the retributive machinery in place of the bill of particulars drawn up against me during my lifetime. This bill is accurate. If I forget this, I am doomed to worry my life away neurotically, feeling endlessly unworthy and a failure, deprecating myself, indicting and impugning myself, reproaching myself, as Satan does in the heavenly court. My conscience endlessly accuses me, and nothing I on my own can do will satisfy it. Have I forgotten 274? And have I also forgotten the messenger vision? All this was done for me, that I would be saved, saved in a sense from myself as accuser. I find myself cursed with a sense of unworthiness. I am not a proud and stubborn person. I am ashamed. Christ died to give me new life and to justify me, and all this has been supernaturally revealed to me. Yet I find myself doing it again, accusing myself for falling short. This is not a small matter. I live with this daily. Every new day stimulates my endless sense of unworthiness. That night when I realized in a flash that 2374 was sudden justification and my awareness of it, have I forgotten that already? That understanding? 2374, as proved e.g. by the messenger vision, was the miracle of Christianity at work on my behalf. As Bill Sarrell said, I am in a state of grace. I have no reason to think I have fallen out of it. 81 K 316. Valis is the cipherbook, code book, to the whole 10-volume meta-novel, and will someday be read as such. And Vallis is Gnostic Mani, but secretly Holy Mother Church. As with God's strategy, the sequence is out of sequence, viz., the key piece, Vallis, came last. Until it, the others did not make sense, i.e., they were taken to have been written as fiction, and hence hypothetical. Vallis retroactively reinterprets them, shows them in a light that could not be anticipated by an analysis of them, until Vallis came out, typical of the pattern strategy of the wise horn in its dialectical combat game. Here is a big realization, and unexpected. Vallis in itself means nothing. Its only significance is as the codebook to the 10-volume metanovel, and no one has noticed this yet, even Greg Rickman. 81 K317. Vallis resembles Ubik and Ubik. This is how the Gnosis is smuggled past the angels. The secret stolen, through the angels in one's hands, and into this prison. It is not transmitted in the proper, meaningful sequence, but is correctly assembled here to spell out the message. The final and essential piece was Vallis. It alters the meaning of all the previous books and stories. The message is not in Vallis. The message is not in the 10-volume metanovel. It is in the latter reinterpreted by the former. Look what it reinterprets the squib opening the final chapter of Ubik into. 81 K 334. For the first time there arose in my mind the notion that Dithion is a fusion of the two distinctly different minds that I call android, machine, schizophrenic, and human, viz., we have not only android, human, Dithion. Ascending hierarchy relates to the three levels of the comedia. 81 K 353. Dream. There is a group of us. We discover that reality, the universe, is actually info. One of us, a girl, recognizes the info as her own prior thought. With a groan, I realize that this means the universe is based on our own prior thoughts. We are forgetful cosmocrators, trapped in a universe of our own making without our knowing it. And I think, I won't believe this when I wake up because the implications are too depressing and radical. It is like maze. The trail which I relentlessly pursue in my exegesis consists of tracks that lead back to surprise, myself. In discovering the laws of God, I am doing nothing more than discovering my own nature, as in philanthropia, love of humanity. The grand illusion is, in fact, the grand tautology. Finally, decipher the writing, info, messages, as basis of reality, and discover I've written it myself, imprisoned in my own mind, with my recirculated thoughts, as in frozen journey, solipsism. Thus, no new knowledge is possible, i.e., synthetic propositions, only analytical. I thought Prajapati, the holy other, is not other at all. The mood of the dream upon the discovery was grim. 81 K 354 E. The first quote from the tractate put forth in Vallis is the essence of it. Thoughts of the brain are experienced by us as arrangements and rearrangements, change, in a physical universe. But in fact, it is really information and info processing which we substantialize. All that is needed is to perform the Tattvamasi equation, and remember that we ourselves thought these thoughts. Well, the reader who reads Maze or Ubik can fill in the gaps, or really any substantial constituent of the 10-volume metanovel. But the girl in the dream was right. To recognize the info basis of world as your own prior thought, although discovering this is actually the summit of Tibetan Buddhist enlightenment, is really a bummer. 81 K 354 F. It's all one vast binary computer acting on instructions from what seems to be a group of living brains combined, as in Maze.